This is the panel on privacy and the global information infrastructure. We have an outstanding group of panelists here today. I think we're going to have a great discussion. I wanted to begin quickly before I introduce our panel with a few propositions. You'll find these on page 79 in the program. First, governments have a responsibility to protect privacy. Second, governments have no responsibility to protect privacy. Third, technology will protect privacy. Fourth, law will protect privacy. Privacy issues on the net are trivial. Privacy issues on the net are hard. The United States is out in front on the privacy debate. The United States is way behind on the privacy debate. Privacy standards should be global. Privacy standards should be local. There is great need to protect privacy. There is no need to protect privacy. In the year 2000, there will be a lot more privacy. In the year 2000, there will be a lot less privacy. There is at the back of the program just a quick true-false list of which of those statements are correct. Oh. I'm sorry, I think they've left the page out, so we'll try to get that for you a little bit later. As I said, we have a great panel. We're picking up this issue at a time when much is happening. The European Union has recently passed a data directive which establishes privacy standards across Europe, raises questions about compliance for countries in North America. We also know that in the past year, David Chaum received the award from the European Union for technical achievement for his DigiCash scheme at roughly the same time that Phil Zimmerman was fleeing prosecutors in the U.S. Now, to introduce our panelists. Our first speaker is Peter Hustings. Peter is both the Data Protection Commissioner for the Netherlands and also the chair of the working group for the European Union that will make decisions about the adequacy of privacy laws in other countries. Our second speaker is Paul-André Cormeau, who is the Privacy Commissioner for Quebec, which is also the leading privacy agency in North America, having moved aggressively in the last few years to establish privacy standards for the private sector. Our third speaker will be FTC Commissioner Christine Varney. Ms. Varney has played a leadership role within the administration on privacy issues and is also formerly Cabinet Secretary in the White House. And our fourth speaker is Colin Bennett, Professor of Political Science at the University of Victoria and also author of the book Regulating Privacy. Peter.
Thank you. Yes, indeed, some interesting things have been going on in Europe, interesting developments which you might want to hear about. Let me say right at the start that although the United States has been very influential in the early days, very influential in the development of the notion of privacy and a right to privacy, my impression is that certainly over the last 25 years that has changed and the U.S. is become somewhat out of touch. Then in the first day of this conference, it was very obvious to me that a large proportion of this audience was very keen on the question of free encryption, and I think it's a very important issue. But it's by no means the only privacy issue which is at stake. And there is considerably less attention, I think, for questions how to deal with the privacy of employees, how do employers take care of the privacy of their employees? What about medical data? What about credit card information? What about welfare information and what have you? Now, to sketch the scene in brief terms, you have to realize that in Western Europe, the European Convention on Human Rights was accepted in 1950, and it provides a general right to privacy, Article 8 of that convention. It is a general right which does not go without exceptions, but the exceptions have to fulfill certain strict criteria. And the convention lays down a rather strong, certainly on international standards, a rather strong enforcement machinery. There is a commission, European Commission of Human Rights, and there is a European Court of Human Rights, which has delivered a number of decisions explaining what this right to privacy means. In many countries, this convention is a self-executing convention. That means that it applies in each member state of the Council of Europe directly. And in a number of countries, among them my own, it has direct priority over every national measure. So it's a convention with teeth. Now, basically, the right to privacy of that convention is a right directed to the state. The state should not intrude upon it. But in a number of cases, the European Court of Human Rights has explained that it's not only a negative obligation, the right to privacy has also a positive dimension. That means that the state has to make sure that there is a sufficient infrastructure, a legal framework, to make sure that privacy is respected not only by itself, but by other organizations and persons in society. Now, that's a very essential notion to keep in mind to understand what is happening in the European scene. Secondly, over the last 25 years, a number of countries have taken this positive action to provide this legal framework to deal with privacy vis-a-vis personal information. And it is a field which has the key term data protection. Countries like Sweden, Germany, and France took the lead in the 70s. But by now, all European countries, even some of the new democracies in Eastern Europe, have legislated or are about to legislate on this issue. In a number of countries, this right to data protection has itself constitutional standing, Germany being the most obvious example. The famous case in 1983 of the German Constitutional Court setting out the doctrine of informational self-determination. Now, that is not a notion which is accepted in all countries, but it's certainly a source of inspiration. In 1981, these countries agreed on a convention which laid down the basic principles of data protection legislation. In 1981, roughly coinciding with the guidelines to that subject, the guidelines of the OECD, an organization which has among its members not only these European countries, but a number of countries in North America and the United States among them. Now, let me just briefly explain some of the key principles of data protection, some of which were mentioned on the first day to our keynote speaker, Mr. Mitsotakis. The purpose principle, which means that personal data, personal information, can only be collected and stored, processed, used for a specific legitimate purpose, a specific purpose, not more information than is required for that purpose, and that information could not be used for other purposes unless they are closely related, the compatible use clause. Now, that's revolutionary, but it is to the heart of this debate. Second principle is the transparency principle, the right to know what is going on, no data collection behind your back. And it also includes the right of access to personal information in the public sector or in the private sector, no distinction. A third principle is the principle of independent supervision. Now, that's sensitive, but it is a sound principle in all European countries. It means that in order to make these principles really bite and to make them effective in society, you need some independent mechanism of oversight, and that is the Office of different notions, different terms, but by and large, privacy commissions in all these European countries. Key to these agencies is that they are independent. Sometimes they report to Parliament, sometimes it's a different arrangement, but independence is key. They have a role of counseling the government, also private organizations, complaint handling, largely ombudsman type, and also investigation auditing, and sometimes a role in stimulating self-regulation. Now, since these data protection principles set the rules of the game for information handling, they are also the rules of the game in the marketplace of information services, goods, and so on. Now, you have to realize that the European Union, the European Community, is based on the principle of free movement of goods, services, capital, and persons. And a lot of these movements are closely related to information. So, all these European countries having data protection legislation, there was a need to make sure that these legislations were sufficiently harmonized, coordinated, in order to make the European market function. And that's why the European Communities Commission, a lot of commissions there, the European Commission took the initiative 5 years ago in proposing this harmonization scheme, the European directive. It took some time to get it in its final shape, but it was finally agreed upon, adopted in October last year, adopted by the Council of Ministers and the European Parliament at the same time. The same data protection principles which I mentioned before, although somewhat adapted, somewhat stronger, sometimes somewhat simpler, to make them ready for the information society. And one of the main reasons, I repeat that, one of the main reasons to do it on a European scale was to make sure that the European communities were ready for the information society. There are some very interesting elements in that directive. Apart from the data protection principles which I mentioned, purpose principle, transparency and independent supervision, it deals with, say, territoriality in a very interesting way, because information moves around without regard to whatever territoriality you can think of. So the directive contains a provisional on jurisdiction where the law of the establishment of the responsible party decides which law applies. It's not the law where the information is, it can be anywhere, but it's the law where the human organization or whatever who is responsible for it, what is happening, resides or is established. And secondly, the directive has a provision on relation with third countries, countries outside of the European Union. Now, what is happening there? A number of OECD countries outside of Europe have legislated upon this issue as well. And I mentioned New Zealand and Australia and Canada. New Zealand having a Privacy Act covering both the public and the private sector. In Australia and Canada, there is federal legislation, and there is a clear move, and we will hear more about it, I'm sure, a discussion at least, to extend the scope of that legislation to the private sector. The USA, in that respect, is certainly lagging behind. Now, the directive has a provision that transfer of information to countries which do not provide adequate protection is in principle not allowed. There are certain exceptions, but that is an entirely different ballgame. What is adequate protection? That's a difficult notion. It's being discussed upon now, and it has to be decided. Now let me say this. Key to this is, I think, first, that any scheme which exists or may exist in a country has to be effective. If it doesn't have sufficient teeth, it's no good. And part of the scheme to make it effective is, I think, the existence of certain institutional arrangements which give sufficient guarantees that whatever is said that should happen really does happen. In conclusion, in the European perspective, balance in the information society is key. Privacy is basic for the information society, is one of the basic values, not only a value, it's a civil right. It's a constitutional principle in all these European countries. And why? Because we think that it is necessary to keep this information society in balance, to keep it healthy, and to keep it sound. I can envisage three scenarios. One scenario is the well-known Big Brother. It's a strong government with a lot of information technology, a lot of surveillance, and no privacy. Second scenario, not a Big Brother, but a little sister. It's a weak government, or a limited government, and the number of big organizations taking over. And these big organizations use a lot of information technology, there's a lot of surveillance, and there is very little privacy. Now, we don't want
either one.
Balance is necessary. To that extent, privacy is part of the arrangement to keep the balance in society. And let me add, as a final remark, it is not only a civil rights issue, because in a number of countries it was decided to take this course simply because one thought that it was a good course of action, it was good for business, and it was just the right way to do. Thank you.
Good morning. To some of you, it may be a surprise or a shock to learn that in Quebec, protection of personal information or data is guaranteed both in the public and private sectors. The Privacy Act, which came into force a little bit more than 3 years ago, is slightly different, but not that much, from the legislations in most of European countries Peter Hastings referred to a few minutes ago. As a matter of fact, and for the time being, New Zealand, Hong Kong, and Quebec seem to be the only three political systems outside Europe with full privacy acts. You have to keep that in mind, because my remarks about privacy and the Global Information Infrastructure, GII, take into account that very basic fact. As a Quebec Information and Privacy Commissioner, my approach to that sensitive question of privacy on Internet and generally speaking on the information highway is rather peculiar. I am deeply concerned, but at the same time I'm also fascinated by the problems raised by this new technology. This morning I'll address the topic allocated to this round table very simply. First, I'd like to start with a basic and easy question. Why should privacy commission like mine or Peter Hastings, Dutch Registrar Chamber, be involved at all? Let's make one thing clear. We are not interested because there is an internet fraud or hate literature or that sort of things, even if that fact does not please me as a citizen. We have to get acquainted with the issues and questions about internet because privacy is part of the old picture. A year and a half ago or so, I was almost laughed at when I talked to a distinguished audience about the myths already surrounding Internet. The network of networks, did I tell them, is not anymore the place where only culture and information are the main data exchange. Internet is going commercial, and it is quite difficult to believe this trend will stop in the years to come. You won't be learning anything from me this morning. You know quite well how it is possible and even easy to collect and store a lot of personal information about anyone browsing, let's say, over Playboy's website or any other more business-like webs, like newspapers, data banks, or even libraries. These data can be retrieved and stored for profiling or building targeted lists, quite useful for direct marketing purposes. If and when webs are commercially oriented, personal information has to be exchanged. All of us have heard stories about frauds and other nice things already going on. But we are not dealing with crime prevention or something like that. As far as personal data are involved, there must be fair information practices. It would be untrue to say that it can be done quite easily without any problems. Privacy commissioner or experts or even privacy advocates must find ways to see how these principles may be enforced in such a different and volatile environment. Multinationals like Visa and MasterCard are also looking for practical answers to these basic problems. I do submit that the small privacy experts community should launch or monitor projects, pilot projects, either to understand the problems or to test technologies or even rules and guidelines that could at least enhance privacy. Yesterday I was quite happy to learn that lawyers and academics in this country are joining their efforts and promoting research about cyber law. The problem with the net or internet is a huge one because of its international dimension, just to choose the most obvious of its characteristics. According to many observers, it is foolish to try and settle the issue. Let me disagree with that cliché. Centuries ago, the first elements of the law of the sea were considered as a good achievement. A few centuries later, and a few years before the start of a new millennium, the law of the sea is still an unfinished house, but it is more than useful, even if there are still outstanding issues to be addressed. With respect to internet and cyberspace, the road will be long and pace quite fast. It would be unwise and even dangerous not to get our act together and not to start research projects. I hope you will allow me to be more specific and even parochial. Next fall, the Quebec Privacy Commission staff will start monitoring the first large-scale commercial info highway to be launched, at least in Quebec. More than 35,000 households will be linked to that commercial highway using cable TV lines. A compulsory code of conduct drawn by professors from the University of Montreal deals with almost all the issues that can be related to that kind of commercial transactions. And one of its chapters is devoted to privacy matters. We will be monitoring the usefulness, if any, of this code, and we hope to find out how it will ensure one's privacy when doing business on this commercial highway. We may be able to conduct such technology assessments in different settings. Of course, the findings have to be measured and evaluated. In our case, our Privacy Act and even the new Civil Code will be the stick yard. My second set of remarks may surprise some of you again. They are related both to technology itself and human nature. I would be most surprised if surfing on the net and exchanging email will make any significant change in the long run in that respect. Men and women before us on this planet have discovered and invented a lot of important things, but did it bring any dramatic change? Since we learn walking on two legs, on two feet, our basic needs and behavior may be, of course, more and more sophisticated, but that's all. I'm not a philosopher, but when facing a new problem and a challenge, I always come back and start with the basic question. when dealing both with internet and privacy, I don't see any need to do anything else. Of course, I do agree that the challenge stemming from the global nature of the net is much more difficult to cope with. This world dimension does not mean that browsing on the net or buying a book from a publisher is, legally speaking, different from what we are used to do, and we are still used to do, prior to this new age of communication. We have to pay attention to the real meaning of technology. If we want to be humble enough for just a moment, one fact of life has to be taken care of. The info highway will be a very useful step to better, cheaper, and more global communications on this planet. Centuries ago, the goal was the same when African tribesmen used special drums to spread good and bad news. Privacy as such will keep on meaning the same thing even when every citizen in our respective countries is linked to the net. But the threats to privacy will be more difficult to cope with. I do agree. This is my common sense approach. I learned to be quite cautious when I was working for my PhD in the middle of the 60s. At that time, the vast majority of political scientists truly believed the world was about to be changed and going totally democratical thanks to political and social development. It was part of the power flower creed of the Woodstock generation, at least the intellectual ones among them. With the global nature of the net and the information society, we have to think globally. We have to find solutions to most of the problems pointed at during this conference. And these solutions must be based on the very principles spelled out both in national and international laws. In Quebec, as well as in most of the countries represented here, we do value privacy. As a matter of fact, the two privacy acts, both for public and private sectors, were passed unanimously by our parliament back in 1982 and more recently in 1993. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we do not anticipate much problems complying with the European directive Peter Hastings referred to when it comes into force in 1998. If you want to know more about that question, you may pick up a leaflet I left on the table at the back of the room. To sum up my remarks, I'd like to underline the need for a common sense approach to the privacy problems and the need of a common or more global and then strictly national approach than we have been used to. Thank you very much.
I'm Christine Varney. I'm a Federal Trade Commissioner, and as we used to say, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. See, you all laugh. You don't want me to help you. I also often begin my speeches by saying, yes, it's true, I'm a federal regulator, but I don't want to ruin your business. I don't want to raise your children. I don't want to tell you what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But at the same time, I recognize that you need some guidance from us as to what we are thinking about and what we're doing when it comes to privacy on the net. I think if I asked how many people here who are not from Washington and not lawyers can name what the Federal Trade Commission has done in the last 5 years or what it's about, I wouldn't get very many hands. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about who we are and what we're thinking about privacy. And then I'm going to try and keep my remarks brief because I'm much more interested in hearing from you. The Federal Trade Commission is established by the Congress and directed to prevent and prosecute deceptive or unfair acts or practices in trade or commerce. That is probably one of the broadest statutes on the books in the United States. We have two missions at the Federal Trade Commission. We are, in the United States, what's commonly known as the Competition Authority or the Antitrust Authority. So we have another side of our business that you probably are all interested in. We actually brought the first Microsoft case, and we review lots of the transactions that are going on in both the hardware and software side of the industry. We have a consumer protection mission, which is what we use to attempt to get into some of these privacy issues. We administer what many people believe is the most significant privacy law on the books in the United States, and that's the Fair Credit Reporting Act. We had started last May a dialogue on the GII and what was the Federal Trade Commission's role in the emergence of the GII here in the United States. And the topics were very broad-ranging. It was 3 days of incredible discussion from many of the panelists that you've heard from here at your conference. And one of the issues that emerged as something that we needed to work on seriously was privacy. What we're also working on, and I won't talk too much about today, we're working on a lot of fraud. We have pretty serious partnerships with several of the online service providers where we prosecute fraudulent advertising that comes over the net. And we're looking at some other practices in the industry that we think may be unfair or deceptive, and we're opening investigations in that arena as well. On privacy, we think that we are probably one of the only agencies in the United States that has actual working day-to-day jurisdiction to do something about privacy. We start from the premise that the laws that are on the books today exist in cyberspace. We are looking at whether or not they are adequate or inadequate, and if they are inadequate, where do we go? Although I think the Europeans and the Canadians may be far ahead of us in legislation, I've got to tell you, with the exception of the Communications Decency Act, this is not a good time to try and legislate in Washington. We have a Congress that is very much opposed to federal legislation and regulation in most areas. I don't see any congressional action coming on the privacy front without pressure from business and consumers. If business says, look, we can't do what we need to do in Europe and in Canada without some support from you, then I think you'll maybe see something in Congress. So what are we doing? Well, we have started a privacy initiative at the Federal Trade Commission where we have an online dialogue through our listserv. We think this is probably one of the first exercises in conversational government in the United States where we are listening to you and to other members of the industry and consumers about what they think the privacy needs are. We participate in the listserv, but mostly we lurk and learn. So we're on there when you're on there. As a matter of fact, we had to have a big discussion inside the FTC about what our own privacy policy was. When people sign up to get onto our listserv, what do we do with that information? I advocated that we destroy it after we get it. So I think I can assure you that the information that you give us is only used for us to contact you back, and I'm not clear. I think our general counsel is investigating what federal record statutes apply to us and what we would have to keep. So, be forewarned. When you talk to the government, there's a record. We will be having, I think, in early June, our next workshop on privacy, where I hope we'll be able to sit down with many of you and with many parts of the industry and hammer out some privacy guidelines for getting on the net. I want to take a minute and show you something that happened yesterday that Mark was involved in Washington, where the consumer, Center for Media Education held a press conference and petitioned us to open some investigations. And I want to show you what they brought to our attention. Does this come out? Okay. What the Center for Media Education did was said, look, there are a lot of sites on the net right now that are targeting children, and they are soliciting information from these children that they believe is unfair. I don't know if you can see this very well on the screen, but it is a kid's place on the net that solicits information from the kids before they can get on and play. And it starts with who are you, your name, your birthday, whether you're a boy or girl, how many people live in your house, what grade you're in. And then they go on to ask you your interests, your zip code, the part of the world where you live, who you will be in the future. It gives you a couple of career choices. God forbid you have an alternative career in mind. Continues on, if you could live anywhere in the world, where would you live? And then it gets into another area. There were a lot of questions about your athletic preferences. Your five-year-old is going to be telling someone what kind of athletic shoes they wear, where they buy them, what brand they are. more of the athletic shoes questions. And then they go to a little game area where it appears that you can get points for signing up your friends for this program. Any and guess what you win when you get all the points? You're right, shoes. You can look in the loot locker, and you can get all kinds of good things. You can, for those of us who worry about our kids eating too much junk food, we've got a whole case of Nabisco cookies here, and you know, goldfish, all kinds of great stuff. But I have to tell you, there's an enormous debate in Washington right now. They look at this stuff and everybody says, oh my God, you know, how can you let this go on? Federal Trade Commission, you are derelict in your duty. You need to go out and you need to regulate this industry. This should be illegal. Well, I'm not commenting on the specifics of what you just saw, because if it does come before us, I have to be an impartial judge. But I do want to emphasize, right, I'm a mom too. So, you know, there are laws on the books under which we can prosecute behavior that we think doesn't comply with a fairness standard or a deception standard. And I think that I would like to be able to come back to you in a year and report on the number of cases that we will have brought within the next year on those issues. My own view, notwithstanding the pressure that we're going to have from the European Union to meet their standards, is we need to start where we are. We have a number of laws that we can prosecute under. We need to start doing that. We need to empower consumers to make choices about dealing with merchants who don't protect their privacy. One of the things that I have thrown out for discussion, and I don't know whether it would work, is a kind of paradigm where you have a set of privacy preferences, where every consumer in America could determine what their privacy preference was. Number one being, I don't want information used about me for anything other than the fulfillment of the transaction I'm involved in, period. Number four being, use it for whatever you want, two and three somewhere in between. Well, why can't we have a system where your privacy preference is automatically programmed into your software, and any time you visit a site, if they don't accept your privacy preference, they put a sign up. Sorry, we don't accept your privacy preference. Click here to go back, or click here if you want us to tell you what our rules are and why we would like you to use them. I don't know if that works. I don't know if that's sensible, but it seems to me that this technology, which presents us so many issues, also presents us some possible solutions. I'd like to see us explore them. I'd like to see us make industry understand that the privacy principles that have grown up in the United States out of the penumbra of rights in the Constitution, you know, it's important to remember in our country, privacy is not an enumerated constitutional right. I don't think it's useful for us to spend a lot of time talking about whether it's a civil right in this country, whether it's a property right, or whether it's a contract acquired right. There are privacy principles that we should enforce, and we need to figure out how to give consumers the tools to not deal with businesses that don't play fair when it comes to privacy. So that's what we're looking at doing. The government has done a couple of things. They issued the OMB privacy principles, then they issued the Commerce Department issued the NII working group privacy principles. We thought they were interesting. They were fairly broad. I say to the people at Commerce and OMB all the time, I take their work seriously because I think they're advising me. I'm the part of the government that has the jurisdiction to help industry develop regulation or self-regulation, and I'm the part of the government that has the ability to prosecute those people that are violating fundamental fairness principles. So within that context, what we need to do is be more specific, and that's what I hope we're moving towards. I hope I can come back to you next year and report that we have a good set of privacy guidelines and that we've prosecuted those that don't play by them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark's given us these incredibly straightforward propositions, which you'll find on page 79 of your program. And,
I wrote my answers.
And Commissioner, I have Commissioner Varney's copy of the program here, and she scrawled her answers on it.
And
so now I have your consent,
you
right?
Tell them.
Governments have a responsibility to protect privacy. Yes, obviously. Governments have no responsibility to protect privacy. No, obviously. Technology will protect privacy. She says yes. I say sometimes. Law will protect privacy. She says yes. I say sometimes. Privacy issues on the net are trivial. She says no. I say yes. Privacy issues on the net are hard. She says yes. I say yes. The U.S. is out in front on the privacy debate. She says no. I say no. The U.S. is way behind on the privacy debate. Aha! She says no. I say yes.
But I'm in the debate. I can't be that far behind.
I know the U.S. is way behind in the privacy debate because I was asked to show a photo ID last night when I wanted to get a beer in this hotel. So I'm surprised somebody hasn't mentioned that so far at this conference. Privacy standards should be global. Yes, I agree with Paul André Comeau. Privacy standards should be local. Yes, they should also be local. There is great need to protect privacy. Yes, clearly. There is no need to protect privacy. No, clearly not. In the year 2000, there will be a lot more privacy. No, no, definitely not. In the year 2000, there will be a lot less privacy. I'm continually amazed as an academic looking into this subject at how new surveillance technologies with subtle implications for our personal privacy are continually, subtle and not so subtle implications for our personal privacy, are continually eroding our identities, our personal freedoms, etc. I have two general points that I want to make, having sort of answered the questions, so we get those off the table. Now I can sort of say what I want to say. Firstly, this. As Mark mentioned, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Regulating Privacy, and one of the things I was interested in is the way that privacy policy is made around the world. And I discussed in that book what I considered the forces for policy convergence. And I won't get into those, but they are technological, they are legal in terms of harmonization. There's also strong forces for lesson drawing or emulation or learning across boundaries. And I would argue that these forces are getting stronger. Like it or not, in the United States, there is a consensus among most countries in the world about what a data privacy law should look like. And that consensus, as has been expressed by Peter Hustings, is that there should be a legal codification of fair information principles. There should be oversight by an independent agency, and that they should apply both to the public and the private sectors. And I would note that it is becoming increasingly difficult to determine where the public sector begins and the private sector ends now. So if one looks at the overall global pattern of privacy protection policy in the years ahead, it is probable, I would say, that all OECD countries will have some version of a data privacy law based on the EU directive, with the exception of the United States. I mean, at the moment, countries like Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Hong Kong, Taiwan have data privacy laws based on that European model. Now, in the future, as of today, I suspect that the arguments for American exceptionalism will continue to be justified by a number of arguments, most of which I think are spurious. They will be justified by the multinational businesses who will say that they are able to take care for themselves, thank you very much, by forging contracts with their European partners. There will also be the argument that the United States has data privacy by other means. The hodgepodge of federal state laws that exist in the United States, if you add it all up and if you look at it in total, is tantamount to the kind of comprehensive privacy regime that exists in a country like the Netherlands. I disagree with that. There are some enormous gaps in American privacy law. And thirdly, of course, there's this overall argument that you get that the United States is different. Well, yes, the United States is different. The question is whether those differences should make a difference. There is a divergence, I think, between the way that Europeans approach this problem and the kind of conversations that we have in conferences like this. I don't see any reason for that divergence becoming less in the years ahead. But I do want to conclude by suggesting that maybe in Canada we have an approach which American policymakers might want to take more seriously than they have up to now, because Canada is caught in a very real sense between the pressures from Europe and the commercial pressures from this country. And there are two aspects of the Canadian policy that I just want to draw your attention to, and there's more information at the back. The first thing, it seems to me, that in Canada is that we have recognized quite clearly that there are really four approaches to protecting privacy on the global information infrastructure. One is law. A second is self-regulation, codes of practice. A third, obviously, is consumer education, awareness. And a fourth is technologies of privacy, encryption, etc. And I would argue that all of those are necessary conditions for the protection of personal privacy on the information highway, but none is a sufficient condition. All are necessary conditions, but none is a sufficient condition. And the question is how the balance between those four approaches will be struck in different societies in the years ahead. The second aspect of this, and which I'd like to draw your attention to, is the fact that in Canada we have developed the first national standard for privacy. And some people are quite excited about this. The Canadian Standards Association, several years ago, set up a stakeholder committee that was comprised of private sector, government, and consumer groups. And 2 weeks ago, after 3 years of intense debate and a lot of hard work, including by a couple of federal officials who are in the audience today, in particular Andrew Neil of Justice Canada and Stephanie Perrin of Industry Canada, 2 weeks ago, the standard was published. It might look to you as if it's just a reshuffling of the OECD guidelines with a bit of the European directive thrown in and, you know, a bit of the Quebec law as well. You know, it's a typical Canadian compromise on things. However, I just don't want to emphasize this. It's a standard, not a code of practice, not window dressing, not something that's been devised one afternoon in the vice president's office of a major corporation. It is a standard. It's the national standard of Canada, and therefore can be integrated into existing standard-setting mechanisms that exist both in Canada and overseas. I did the research report for this process and try to figure out registration processes that companies might use in order to register their not only their codes but also their practices to this standard. And questions then have to be raised about what claims they should then be allowed to make, and the obligations also to be audited under the standard in the same way, for example, that businesses are audited under the ISO 9000 series of quality assurance standards. There are certain parallels between the privacy protection rules and aspects of the ISO 9000 series. I don't know how familiar you are with that. But it's my hope that in certain big businesses, at any rate, that pressure from both consumers, from clients, from government, and also from people like Peter Hustings might force our businesses, at any rate, to take privacy seriously and to register to that standard and be audited. Many of us want to go a lot further. There is a hope, and certainly this is my position, that the standard will form the framework for federal legislation in Canada. That process is beginning and it might occur. I can't say any more than that. But I note that our Canadian Direct Marketing Association has made a call for federal legislation based on the national standard, which is something probably that the American Direct Marketing Association would find extremely bizarre. The other thing, and finally I'd say, is this, right? Yeah. is that there's a possibility, and this process is also beginning, of developing an ISO standard on privacy itself. This is just at the outset, but I'd say that I think that that is a possible instrument that can help the Europeans in enforcing their adequacy standard under the European Union directive by by forcing some compliance auditing, it also might be something that the U.S. business and the U.S. government might want to take a look at in the debates and the problems that, that you're going to have to confront up here. Thank you.
We'll have some time for questions from the audience, but I'd like to begin with a couple of questions of my own and bring this discussion down to earth a little bit, or maybe more precisely to put it back out in cyberspace. But let's imagine for the moment, a couple of years hence, that there's a big company in the United States that's involved in providing programming services for young kids, and we'll just call this company Quarterlodeon. And they are operating a website, and they have on their website, in addition to a lot of information about their program and services and so forth, surveys like the one Commissioner Barney showed you. And I should mention, by the way, at the EPIC site, which is epic.org, you can get a link on the homepage directly to that report and those screenshots if you're interested in seeing that. So they put up a survey form, and they ask people who visit their website to fill out the form, and if they fill out all of the blanks that are on the form, then they will accumulate points for prizes or be entered into a drawing or something similar. And people around the world visit this site. I mean, it's got a lot of cool stuff on it. They want kids to hang out there. You've got kids from US and Europe and so forth entering data at the site. And I guess my question would go first to Peter Hustings. Is this going to raise a problem for the privacy principles that you've set out in the directive?
First, there is, of course, the issue of jurisdiction, but let's assume that this would happen within my or European jurisdiction, not Dutch or European. Then we would look at the Data Protection Act on the basis of the European directive, according to this directive, and then I would first see whether the responsible company you mentioned would have a sufficiently legitimate interest in putting that up and offering that arrangement. And if that were the case, I would then look at the compliance with the other data protection principle, in this case, sufficient transparency, fair information, fair collection, and if that was all the case, and the information was used only for the purpose which was made explicit beforehand, then it would seem to me that it is up to the consumer, the user, or what have you, to make up its mind whether he likes it or not, and that's it. However, if we would find a breach of these principles of any kind, and it would be a serious matter, we would say that is unsafe, illegal, and we go after it. And if this would arise in a, say, international context, then I think in Europe we would have a sufficient leverage to make this international company understand that it's just not a wise business practice. And if you've heard what happened in Bavaria, there was some overreacting there, but certainly the message is that it is of some interest to a company what its clients, its market thinks about it. So I think we might well find it unacceptable if one of these main principles were not expected.
I have a question also for Commissioner Barney. And it's based on the system she described as privacy preferences. And as I understand this, the premise is that as you travel the net, you would have associated with your identity some privacy preference, one for the most restrictive perhaps, and four for, you know, do whatever you please with my data, And when you meet a company or an organization on the net, they would note your privacy preference and tell you whether or not they're, you know, prepared to work with you. A lot of companies might say, well, this is too restrictive. We don't want people who fall into the first category, but we'll take you in the second category or something like that. And one of my questions, I guess, is this type of identity-based preference scheme. It's a little bit like a hall of mirrors. And don't you see some risk here of the articulation of preferences leading to the use of that information for more marketing purposes? In other words, if you knew who was in group one, these are the people you'd be selling security services to, and, you know, Venetian blinds and so forth. And isn't really the better approach, if we could make it work, some kind of anonymous scheme? Basically, companies want to get paid for their services, which is understandable, but the privacy issue begins once we're exchanging personally identifiable information.
Right.
And if the technology allows us to avoid the collection of personally identifiable information, isn't that better?
I think that anonymity guarantees privacy. So wherever you can conduct a transaction anonymously, you're obviously securing your privacy in a way that you can't otherwise. I agree with that. I also believe, though, that it's not a bad thing to create a market demand for privacy. If we have enough type ones, then, you know, businesses are going to start to be responsive to people who want their privacy protected and object to, you know, any reuse, any secondary use of their data. So I think there is room, certainly, for anonymity, although, you know, when you order from a catalog and you've got to have it delivered to your home, it's a little hard to think about how that could be a completely anonymous transaction. So the answer is yes and yes. And if I can go back and just comment a little bit on your Cortelodeon example, one thing in the United States, at least with the Federal Trade Commission, is that we have a demonstrated ability and commitment to what we call vulnerable populations. And we do specific rulemaking and carve-outs for what we have in the past identified as vulnerable populations, the elderly when it comes to telemarketing, disabled when it comes to health claims, non-English-speaking communities when it comes to some products, and children. So we indeed could conceivably have a system in this country where there are much more rigorous standards when it comes to children than could be in place for the rest of the population.
Okay. Before we turn to questions, I'd like to take just a quick survey of the audience using those four categories, where category one is the most restrictive. You don't want your data disclosed for any purpose whatsoever. Category two being you can do it if you contact me and get my permission. Category three, I'd like the option to say no, but you can basically do it. And category four is have a good time with it. How many people fall into category? Yes.
Right.
They may also be in category one. I don't know. But all right. Well, we'll leave it category five. But just quickly, a show of hands. One being the most restrictive use of personal information, and four being the least restrictive. How many in the first category here? Very interesting. How many, I'm going to get your names after this, maybe you're subscribed.
I'm writing it down.
You're subscribed to the Epic newsletter. And how many in the second category? And how many in the third category? And how many in the fourth category? Well, very interesting. I mean,
it's sort of, you forgot five.
That sort of suggests maybe we're in an opt-in environment in this room in terms of secondary use of data. Okay, let's take
But Mark, let's ask the follow-up question. How many people in this room want to see government go in and regulate that?
Well, that's interesting. Good question from a government regulator. Yes. We'll keep you employed. Don't worry. There will be plenty to do.
That's why I asked. I mean, you know, privacy is very important, but most netizens that I've talked this over with kind of scratch their head for a minute and say, wait a minute, am I telling you I want you to come in and regulate my behavior or the people I do business with their behavior? And essentially you are. But go ahead.
Yes, please. I have a question. Chuck Morrison, lawyer, San Francisco. I have a question for the commissioner from Quebec. The biggest dichotomy in privacy laws among countries is those countries like the United States that protect files in the hands of governments, but pretty much leave the private sector alone. Exceptions, Fair Credit Reporting Act, a few other things. But generally speaking, the big divide is that the jurisdiction regulates government records and leaves private sectors alone. And jurisdictions like Quebec and the European Union, who have very similar treatment and rules for both public and private sector records. At the Discovery Institute's International or Internet Law Symposium last October, an Ontario Privacy Commissioner professional said that Quebec had posed a particular problem for the rest of the provinces of Canada, in that unlike the rest of those provinces, it had chosen to regulate both private and public records in quite similar ways, whereas the other provinces fell in the other category, and that this had had a strange normative effect on businesses in non-Quebec provinces in Canada, that they had found that their economy was so intermixed that they really couldn't do business in Quebec unless they started complying with the rules in Quebec. And my questions to you are two. Number one, is that right? Is that good information? And number two, is it possible that the same effect may occur vis-a-vis the United States catching up to the European Union's directive?
As far as the first part of your question is concerned, my answer is right, yes. When the bill was enacted, of course, there were problems, but quite fast, most of the businesses, multinationals, mainly doing business in Quebec, adapted their own code of conduct or practice, and they sold it to the public and said, we are taking good care of your data, you may do business with us, and most of them found out it was a good selling argument. And then most of the Canadian or multinational companies decided that they should go along all across the country and use the same set of standards, which were based on Canadian Act, Quebec Act. And I would just give two examples. Of course, Equifax did comply with the Act. And according to what I've been told, they even changed some of their practice in the States because they take lessons of what was going on in Quebec. And the other strange example comes from the Molson Brewery. And they published an advertisement, and it was circulated in all the pubs and local taverns throughout Quebec. And they explained to the customer, the beer drinker, how they would comply with the Act and why they decided to do so. And that same type of advertisement is ready for circulation in the rest of the country now. So, of course, there were problems, but I was much surprised to see how the enterprises did choose to find the best advantage of the Act itself. And some of the larger companies, when the Act came into force, decided to review all their way and the procedures that they collected data, and to get rid of the unnecessary data they had been collecting on for years and years without any use. These data were completely useless. And they got rid of a lot of data, and they saved between 10% and 20% of their cost in that operation. So people found out their advantage in the Act. Would you repeat the second part of your question? I did not take it.
Whether something similar could happen as between the EU and the United States, as happened between Quebec and the other provinces of Canada. That is to say, the EU treats public and private sector files quite similarly. And are American companies, in your opinion, going to start complying with EU standards, even though American law currently doesn't require them to do so, so that they can easily do business in Europe? Is it possible that it would work that way?
I really don't know. This is something quite almost in the science fiction world.
Just very briefly, react. First, of course, I'd be delighted, and I think all my colleagues in Europe would be delighted. But secondly, I don't understand why an American company doing business in Europe and doing business well in Europe, according to the data protection principles, in conformity with, could not do the very same in America. I don't see why it should distinguish at all. So to that extent, I sympathize with the Quebec position very much. I hope they will find it out very soon.
John?
Hi. I have a couple of short comments and then a question for the whole panel. One comment is that Christine Varney's suggestion to have a software solution for designating what level of privacy, I think, is already in existence. The PICS standard, the Platform for Internet Content Selection, was designed as a response to the censorship legislation, but in fact it's a general purpose mechanism that could perfectly well be used. For example, an organization like the Electronic Privacy Information Center could provide ratings of other websites to people who are its members or subscribers, and they could configure their web browsers such that they would reject any attempt to connect to a site that would abuse their personal information based on the level of protection they choose. I think bringing out this kind of application of PICS is a very important thing, because I'm afraid it will be stigmatized as simply a censorship means, when in fact it's a much more general way for individuals to choose what kind of content and what kind of exposure they want to have. Second, I would note that the privacy violation here in the hotel, where we were required to show ID, was in fact generated because of an attempt to protect children. So this is a double-edged sword. And my question for the panel is, as people concerned with protecting the privacy of your citizens, do your laws and do your procedures have any impact on the suggestion that your governments are making, that they hold cryptographic keys in escrow for all their citizens? I mean, what is your stance on this? Could you actually stop your countries from doing this to their citizens? And, you know.
This question is particularly relevant in view of the fact that the Dutch government 2 years ago made an attempt, at least informally, to legislate on this issue. It came out very soon, and it was heavily criticized by my office, among many others, and the plan went down. Quite to the contrary, we have been promoting the use of privacy technology as a strong policy. We are in the process of coordinating that kind of policy on a European scale, promoting arrangements like the ones you've heard about, eCash, and there are other options in Canada, BioScript and so forth. And so our position is that encryption should be as free as possible. The as possible is, of course, the hard question. There is always this paradox that under certain circumstances you have to be able to do lawful investigations. Now, there is a question of balance. We are by no means convinced that the balance should be anywhere near the original plans, but that's our position. We're pushing for as much freedom as possible. Thank you.
Well, Well, my answer would be the same. My stand is the same. And I've been promoting for 2 years the use of, this is commercial free, PGB in Quebec. Right.
I should...
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about the PICS standard in response to your question. One of the problems with thinking about privacy as a standard is that it confronts all the claims that are out there about whether a product or a service is in fact privacy friendly. And one of the things I've been trying to think through is the way you try to integrate into any kind of standard setting mechanism an understanding about what is a valid claim and what is an invalid claim. The problem at the moment is that any business can make whatever claim it wants about its privacy policies, and you have no idea whether those policies are being implemented. But I really think there's some potential here to maybe there's models in the eco-labeling kind of areas.
Yeah, well, in fact, the PICS ratings could also be tied in with a standard like an ISO 9000 style that includes some auditing. It also permits multiple organizations to make independent ratings, and it's up to the consumers to choose which among them that they believe. That, you know, if they like Epic's ratings, or they like consumers' unions, yeah, or they like the Federal Trade Commission's rating.
Yeah.
We're into consumer choice. On the... on encryption, you know, look, where the debate started in this country is a very different place from where it is today. It's a fluid debate. It's dynamic. It's evolving. There's a lot of interest at the table. And I would echo the sentiments of my colleague from Europe. It's a balance. You know, we need to be able to have strong government prosecution enforcement of criminal activities, and we need to protect privacy. You know, and the biggest, I think, movement in this country on the encryption debate is coming from business, because they want to be able to do business in Europe, and I think it's moving in the right direction, but we're not done yet.
Okay, I just find it ironic that I haven't heard a strong statement from any of you against the creation of a nationwide database that holds all the keys to all private information and is in the hands of the government.
I don't think that's going to happen. So
I'm against that.
That's obvious. Actually, in answer to your last point, John, I did an article for the next issue of Wired called "Bureaucrats Do Good Privacy," and my point is that people like Mr. Hustings, because they have a position within the federal government to advocate on behalf of privacy, have been able to intervene when proposals to establish technical standards that are averse to privacy are proposed. And I say this is one of the weaknesses with the U.S. system. It's a bit of a paradox, of course, because you may be concerned about government on the one hand, but on the other hand, government, of course, makes decisions in these areas. So the question is, when these decisions are made, will there be an advocate for privacy in that process, or do you see a package, as we saw when CLIPR was first rolled out, that effectively unites the people against the government because it is, you know, out of touch? So I think it's a very interesting. I should also mention that the government of the Netherlands and the Canadian province of Ontario joined together for a report that was released last fall on technologies of privacy called the Path to Anonymity, and they were proposing the deployment of new technical standards such as DigiCash to promote anonymous transactions. So there's a lot going on. Phil.
Bill, I agree. Actually, building on what Mark just said and Mark's previous interchange with Commissioner Varney, a question for the whole panel about regulators' interest in architecture. It seems to me that the traditional approach to data protection coming out of the 70s presupposed that there were data banks of information about people and asked, okay, you know, what about those? What constraints happen on those? What can happen to the data? And so forth and so on. And I think that the privacy debate is moving very much in the direction of a recognition of the implications of architecture for privacy. Is it possible to be anonymous, for example? Many people are concerned that regulatory processes might move slowly enough that de facto standards might become entrenched make privacy protection technically impossible, or that, you know, entrench bad standards in one way or another. You know, take distributed object standards. Imagine the day in late 96, early 97 when distributed object technology gets interlinked with the web in a standardized way, and 10,000 companies all build something on it, and suddenly there are hundreds of millions of people who have an object representing them in this in this scheme. That's the end of the world from a privacy perspective. And so I think it's important to think about the kinds of interests regulators can have in architecture. There's a lot of reticence in industry to have regulators telling them what the architecture of their system should be. And obviously there's going to be some middle ground between just saying be nice on the one hand or saying buy this product on the other hand. For example, the regulators could say we insist that there be a conceptual distinction in electronic commerce systems between the transaction system that handles the payment and the marketer's system that displays products and ultimately collects money from a bank somewhere, and even a distinction between the marketer and, say, a fulfillment organization, that at least that be possible to have that kind of conceptual distinction. I don't think we fully understand the range of kinds of constraints that regulators might want to put on architecture. Commissioner Varney's suggestion hints in that direction in a way that I find intriguing. Also, the standards process in Canada hints in that direction, as well as the anonymity report from Ontario and the Netherlands that Mark just mentioned. And I'd like to hear the perspectives of everyone on the panel about how to conceptualize this new territory of regulatory work on technical architectures.
Yeah, I think your question almost answers itself. I mean, you've laid out the paradigm completely. The regulation can slow the innovation, or the innovation can take us in a direction that regulation is irrelevant. So how do we balance that? Well, how we're attempting to balance that at my agency is to sit down with the industry that's making the architecture possible, that's creating the options, and to sit down with the businesses and the consumers to try and figure out what's the most reasonable environment, but innovation-friendly environment, where we can protect current interests but not inhibit future innovation. I don't know the answer. You're invited to our June 11th workshop, because it's clearly the crux of the question that we're dealing with. Let me say very quickly, I have to leave, but we have at the FTC a listserv. I invite you all to join it. If you have questions for me that I haven't been able to answer, contact me at www.ftc.gov, and I will get you back an answer as quickly as I can. It's been delightful being here with you. You're a really important part of this process, so please keep up with us at the FTC as we move forward, and I hope I'll be able to come back next year with more progress reports.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll go another 10 minutes and take questions and then wrap up. So, yes.
Just a quick one, really. I think there's evidence that regulation is sensitive to the problem that you've identified, and I'll just say one thing. I mean, in the OECD guidelines of the 1970s, there was a distinction made between collection, use, disclosure. The EU directive talks about processing. I think that's an advance, and the CSA standard does as well.
I basically agree with your point. As far as the terminology is concerned, the EU directive is a major step forward, and it's more flexible. Now, essentially this, I think you need the legal principles, and they're clear, and you need the technology combined in conjunction with each other. If, in the example you mentioned, the functional separation, the distinction, follows from the law, that's one conclusion, but you need to organize that distinction in practice. You and there the technology comes in. Now, privacy-enhancing technology allows organizations to set up the arrangements exactly along the lines which they're supposed to be. And so in the report which was mentioned, and you referred to it too, the privacy-enhancing technology report, we conclude that there is a need for, say, standardization of the architecture and the way you design information systems. That idea turns out to be quite fruitful, is being studied upon right now on the European level and is being developed. So we're working on it.
So could I add a word?
Yes.
Yes, it's exactly my line of thinking. I'm strongly in favor of pilots and technology assessment reviews. And in Quebec, we have just completed a report after a four-year monitoring an experiment for smart cards in health car. And we are trying to see how and when smart card can be used safely in order to enhance one's privacy. That's, I think, part of our job, but we have very meager resources to do that.
Okay. Yes.
Well, that set of questions will be a hard act to follow. My name is Richard Threadgill. First, a compliment. If governments are going to involve themselves in an arms race, certainly an arms race of consumer protection and privacy protection for individuals is the best arms race I would hope them to be in. Thank you. Now the question. It is well understood that levels of cultural resistance to law vary wildly over the planet, that in some countries rigid standards will be adopted by the government and the citizenry will say, ah, the world is better now, we have standards, let us follow them. And in others, it just really doesn't matter what you adopt because the citizenry will continue business as usual. And you don't even need to think about things like, well, is this a corrupt government? Will they bribe themselves out of it? It's simply a matter of the regulators won't even think to regulate. Everyone does it. What's the point? And my question is, what thinking is there in the international community about how realistically to address these issues, particularly when some of the likely least sensitive economies are likely to be heavily, heavily involved?
What do you mean by the least sensitive economy?
I can readily see circumstances where, for example, let us say for the moment that Bermuda, I hope there are no Bermudans in the audience I'm offending or in future when they listen to these tapes, let us say that Bermuda really doesn't take a very solid view of what we would think of as traditional consumer protection and privacy protection. And based on this, credit reporting companies, which have in their eyes a legitimate need to really tread fairly heavily on these sorts of issues, decide, well, Bermuda is the place to house all of our data and to do all of our basic business. How do we in the international community address that class of problem?
Well, that's a fairly easy one, actually. It's exactly for this kind of reason that the directive has built in this provision that no transfers are legal to countries like the ones you're describing. And we are convinced that European countries together are able to produce sufficient leverage to make it quite clear, not only clear, but also felt that it's not such a good idea. Then let me add, to be complete, of course, no law can ever be effective to the full 100%, and it's in the electronic age, it is quite easy to, in a split second, to do a lot of illegal things. But let's not forget that these companies and organizations consist of persons. They have markets which consist of persons. They have to operate in the real world, and it is very bad business practice to take chances too long and too easily. So I think it's good sense to think and not to do stupid things like this one.
You said preface your remarks by saying something about different cultures and privacy. I just wanted to respond to that very, very briefly by saying that it's my view that the pressures from technology and also the pressures from international legal regimes, etc., are forcing societies to come to grips with these problems in ways that are increasingly similar. And I've argued, and I think this is controversial, that these processes will continue, and to some extent they override distinctive cultural attributes that one might think would produce differences across nationally. I think that's an argument that's often exaggerated.
Let's take the next question.
Yes, I'm Carol Deppers from the ACLU of Wisconsin's Data Privacy Project. In my prior life, I have represented, unfortunately, a step backwards at the state level for data privacy, personal privacy. I was the only and the first privacy advocate in a state, the state of Wisconsin, until the governor eliminated my office and my privacy council because he wanted government run as a business, which I think is exactly the problem. My question really builds on the first questioner, and I would like some advice from our panelists. One of the first things we attempted to do at a state level was to come up with some standards of fair information practices, and thank you, we drew on your principles and your drafts. However, when we tried to extend that set of standards and principles to the private sector, we ran into significant resistance, which I'm finding, as I testify before the legislature, is continuing today. Building on the first question, what advice do you have for us, particularly at the state level, of how we can have a less adversarial relationship on the issue of fair information practices with private sector? In our country, we seem to have the line drawn in the sand with the concept of information ownership versus information stewardship. I'm not getting very far with the private sector. Can you give me some assistance?
Okay. I have to answer your question with references from Quebec, of course. When the Parliament came out with the bill about the private sector, it came out from one fact of life. We had been living with the Public Sector Act for 10 years at that time, and most of the complaints we were getting in our office were for problems in the private sector. And we used the standard letter, thank you very much, but sorry, we don't have any jurisdiction for that question. And people kept complaining to their local MP and things like that. And finally, the move came not from us, but from the MPs themselves. And the bill was tabled by the then communication minister. And it was passed, which is quite important, unanimously by the House. Over the past 15 years in Quebec, only 4 bills were passed unanimously, which gives, I think, a lead to the minimal consensus within the leadership, the political leadership, and the community. And the second part of your question relates to the relations between the business community and, let's say, people in privacy business. When the government tabled its bill, of course there was strong opposition from the lobby in Quebec, but there was one clear message. If and when you pass an act, then it should be a single act applying across the board to everything, so the standards will be the same and we know where we are going. And I must admit that my first submission to the Parliament was based almost entirely on the Dutch model, which gives precedence to codes of conduct, sectorial or professional codes of conduct. And the business community in Quebec did not buy that. They did want, if necessary, just a single act point. So you have to get into a dialogue with the business community. And for the past almost 3 years now, since the act has came to force, we did set dialogues with various business communities, and we were lucky enough to conclude these negotiations with the insurance community, at least part of the insurance community, and all the insurance companies doing business in Quebec agreed and changed their consent forms on all their insurance policies. And we are now in negotiations with video clubs and things like that. And it's an ongoing process, but it means that we are changing partly way of doing business, which is not quite easy, I do agree.
Getting the insurance commissioner, insurance companies on board, you deserve my congratulations.
Great, thank you. We have time for just two more questions.
Earlier you asked how to choose our privacy level. I chose level 4, so I like to identify myself here. My name is Jane Doe. I'm an 82-year-old grandmother. I have 3 grandchildren. And my original question was for the FTC commissioner, but I'll go ahead and ask it, and I'll ask a question for the other members of the board. She mentioned that she was from the government, and she was here to help us. And they weren't really interested in regulations. They were interested in giving industry guidance. And then she proceeded to go on to mention how she hoped to tell us next year how many prosecutions she had brought about people who didn't follow their guidance. So I wasn't quite sure what the difference between a regulation and guidance was. And my question for the other members of the board are, sometimes these privacy acts seem to give a seal of approval for bad things. In the U.S., we do have few attempts at privacy. And on the federal level, the Privacy Act seems to be one of the favorite tools that various federal departments use not to release information on the grounds it may violate someone's privacy. So I'm wondering if some of these privacy acts are encouraging bad things rather than encouraging good things and then saying it's a good thing anyway.
Well, maybe I can tell you just what we do. Terms of helping people, and then it's not only, single citizens, but it's also private organizations and business and government agency, in fact, who simply have a problem because they realize that the developing information society does pose a lot of problems, and so they come in. And if we counsel them, we try to find the solutions that work. If we deal with complaints, we have hundreds of complaints, cases, and we try to not only solve the cases, but also look behind the complaints and come up with patterns which need attention of legislatures, for instance. So, and investigations and audits, the same thing. So, Privacy Commissioner's Office is part of a structure of checks and balances in which our business is to make sure that the problem society has to solve, come up, and are considered, and are solved. Sometimes we have to fight battles, and sometimes we lose them. That's part of life. And I know that some government agencies, just as well as business companies, use sometimes privacy as a pretext. Then again, it's our role to say, now look, this is not the way it's supposed to be. And then it goes on and on. That's checks and balances.
Before we take the last question, I just wanted to check with the technical people if the tape, if we can roll the tape at the very end of the panel. The 3/4 inch, no? No, okay. Well, that's an answer, I guess. We have a tape which we may be able to show later. I thought it would be particularly nice for this panel. It's Texas Prisoners Do Data Processing. And it's on the whole issue about privacy safeguards, but we'll have to find another way to get that to you. I don't know if it's triple X or just double X or what it may be, but it is Texas Prisoners. Stephanie Perrin.
Thanks. I have 2 points. The first is a follow-up to the ID card issue over the beer. I think that protecting children's not a primary purpose, but a secondary. I think primary purpose, I would suggest, would be limiting liability. And I invite you to ponder this one. Hassling people over ID is discriminatory, and particularly in today's culture, you want to hassle different genders, different cultural groups, based on subjective impressions of their age. And I don't think if I dyed my hair pink and stuck it in a spike, I'd still have any problems getting a beer. But nevertheless, I think that's the real motivation behind this. And it results in a surveillance technique for all, a relatively mild one, but I think it's worth examining. My second point, Richard Threadgill basically stole my question. And I accept some of the answers. This is concerning whether or not this is going to work when exported to developing countries. In my estimation, our record in balancing human rights and trade interests has not been good. And for that reason, I look forward to seeing the enforcement of the directive. But since the determining group will be sitting in the trade division of the EU, correct me if I'm wrong, please, I think that inevitably we're still up against that balance, trade economic interests versus enforcement of human rights. And I invite you all to count how many main trunks are heading into Bermuda these days if you look at telecom distribution. I would just like to make the point and ask for your comments. One of the things that attracts us to ISO registration is the fact that many developing countries are sending large delegations to ISO because they want to get manufacturing accreditation, because they want to trade. And ISO registration is a strong ticket to trade. Therefore, if you link your privacy rights, your technological clearances, and I include encryption as an area that could be hijacked and put in here as well, then you have a hope of enforcing basically a human rights issue in a trade forum. Got any comment on that?
Yeah, okay. Yes, you're right.
Thanks, definitely. That's all I need.
I think it's important to two points, really. The parallels between these existing ISO standards about quality management practices and quality assurance practices and the Code of Fair Information Practices are far more striking than most of us may think. However, it is important to emphasize that when you're talking about a standards approach, that it's not necessarily ISO 9000, because that's an extremely expensive and burdensome approach to solving this problem, more expensive than setting up an agency like Mr. Hustings or Mr. Comeau's. So the dilemma is how to set up some kind of certification or registration system to a standard which you can use for, you know, the local video store. And you know as well as I do that that's an incredibly difficult problem.
Okay, we're going to stop there. I'd like to thank you all and thank the panel for very interesting.